turned out, was having to go to the bathroom. First, Gemma thought she could hold it. Pete tried to get his hands free so he could at least pee in the corner, in a little pile of rags or the empty water bottle that rattled across the floor whenever the van made a turn. But he couldn't get his hands free. She pretended to be asleep, choking on her own panic, on tears she couldn't even wipe away, while the van filled with a sharp metallic stink. Later it was her turn, and she felt a flood of shame that made her want to die, truly die, for the first time in her life. Instead, she slept. Unbelievably, improbably, mercifully, she slept, with her head knocking against the filthy floor and the stink of ammonia everywhere. Every hour or so, the van came to a stop. The drivers were in no particular hurry. Every time, Gemma woke with a start, hoping they'd come to a checkpoint or a roadblock, hoping, though she knew it was impossible, that someone had already realized she was missing, that police had been mobilized across 50 states. But no one came to let them out, and every time, after they lay there in the sweating quiet for agonizing minutes, the van simply started up again. Who knew whether the strangers who'd cuffed and gagged them were fake cops or the real thing, just paid off by somebody higher up? She understood that the truck had been brought, and the accident staged, specifically for the abduction. It was likely Fortner's friends had blocked off all the roads around Winston Abel with more fake accidents or fake checkpoints, scanning for a boy and girl traveling together, acting weirdly, no convincing story about who they were or where they'd come from. By the time the van stopped for good, Gemma and Pete hadn't looked at each other in hours. Her jeans were wet, his too. She was still wearing her party top, which had beaded sequins along the hem. He was in his Hawaiian shirt. She nearly toppled over when she had to stand. The man who'd masqueraded as the truck driver took her arm, surprisingly gentle, as if they were on a date and she had caught a heel in the sidewalk. But the woman who'd posed as a cop stepped forward and seized Gemma roughly. "I'll take this one," she said simply. It was dark except for a ring of headlights in the distance that might have been jeeps, more vans, some kind of security cordon. There were street lamps, but most of them were missing bulbs. People on foot patrolled with flashlights, and in the distance, Gemma made out a big, low, slope-roofed building, barely speckled with light. Long runways of pavement, distant fists of furry trees, signs, A-32I, B-27A, blinking in the sudden clarity of the guards' flashlights. It was an old regional airport. She could even now make out a single hangar, illuminated by the temporary sweep of passing headlights. Where were they? Not Tennessee. They must have been driving for 12 hours at least. She smelled running sap, tilled mud, even a very faint tang of fertilizer. Farmland. Crickets cut the air into sound waves. Stars wheeled prettily above them. Ohio? Indiana? Their abductors removed their gags at last. They were wet and heavy with saliva. Tears of relief burned Gemma's eyes, even though she still couldn't speak. Her tongue felt swollen and painful. Her lips were raw, and her throat dry. She wondered why they'd been gagged in the first place, whether it was just to keep them from talking to each other, or so they would be afraid. Voices shouted in the dark. Someone called, "Hot shit!" And there was even a smattering of applause, as if the people who'd seized Gemma and Pete had instead won several rounds in a bingo tournament.
"Where are you taking us?"
Pete's voice was hoarse, too. She wanted to reach over and squeeze his hands, but she was filthy, ashamed, and besides, her hands, still cuffed behind her back, were numb.
"Nowhere."
The guy who'd been playing male cop sounded tired, almost reproachful, like, "Hey, buddy, I've had a long day, too. At least you didn't have to drive."
"Don't answer it,"
the woman said, hearing Pete referred to like that, like an it, sparked a new terror. My name is Gemma Ives. Gemma's words tasted a little like vomit. They were coming up quickly on the airport, too quickly. A few distant lights had swelled from fireflies to windows. In a few of them, she could make out concrete interiors, wires nested like intestines in the ceiling, banks of leather chairs still bolted to the floor. I'm the daughter of Jeffrey Ives. My dad was one of the original investors in Haven. This is my boyfriend, Pete. You've got it all wrong. We're not who you think we are.
I told you, the woman sighed, speaking directly over Gemma's head, as if she were nothing but air. Not to talk to it.
What does it matter anyway? You want to know where we're going, kid?
Her partner, or whatever he was, wouldn't look at Pete or Gemma, even when he was addressing them.
Nowhere. We're already here.
The old airport terminal rose steep-faced and ugly, like someone's blunt and splintered jaw. There was a faint hiss in the dark, and then the wheeze of rusted hinges. A door. Gemma had known they were in trouble. Big trouble. In the van, she'd sat there grinding her teeth and trying to force her thoughts to settle, to pin them down whenever they flitted out of reach. Like trying to catch horseflies by hand. They'd been followed. The military, or whoever was in charge, had figured out that they were trying to help Lyra and Selim. Maybe they even knew that Selim had managed to slip away, and somehow they blamed Gemma and Pete. But now, for the first time, she understood. The people who'd abducted them didn't think Gemma and Pete had helped the replicas escape. They thought Gemma and Pete were the replicas.
Lyra, 7. Lyra did as she was told. She set off toward the music, and when she got lost, she simply closed her eyes and listened for the drumbeat rhythm of applause and the crackle of distant speakers and turned right or left. She wondered whether Selim had been here, had waited at the crosswalk for the light to turn green as she was waiting, had thought of her or worried about her or wondered whether she would follow. The streets grew more crowded and funneled a mass of people down toward the music. Colored flyers fluttered from the lampposts. People drank in the streets and leaned over the balconies of their high-rises to wave. Lyra was overwhelmed by the crush of people, by the blur of strange faces and a celebratory atmosphere she couldn't understand. Was this another party? She had yet to see any more replicas. The music picked up the tempo of her heart and knocked it hard and fast against her ribs. Then she turned a corner and saw them. Hundreds of identical men milling around a stage elevated in the center of the plaza, all with the same oil-black hair and sideburns and sunglasses, many of them dressed the same too in heeled boots and spangly white uniforms. She cried out without meaning to, filled with a sudden cataclysmic joy. Replicas, hundreds of them, alive, healthy, drinking from red plastic cups, posing for photographs with eager tourists. But then she got closer, and her heart dropped. She saw at once she'd been mistaken. The men weren't identical at all. Some were fat, some were dark, others were pale. There were even women among them, with sideburns pasted to their skin that in places had begun to unpeel. They weren't replicas at all. They were simply regular people, costumed to look the same for reasons she couldn't understand. The disappointment was so heavy she could hardly breathe. All of a sudden she felt trapped, squeezed to death in the vast open space by the pressure of all the strangers around her, by the chaos of so many unfamiliar things. Speakers blew feedback into periodic screeches. Laughter sounded like explosions. The air stank of fried food and sweat. Selim must have come here and seen what she had seen. But where would he have gone afterward? He could have wandered in any direction. He could have left Nashville entirely. She would never find him now. She was suddenly dizzy. Turning to move out of the crowd, she stumbled.
"Whoa, take it easy there, lady. Are you okay?"
A woman squinted at her, and her dark wig, that's what it was, a wig, shifted forward an inch on her forehead.
"You need some water or something?"
Lyra wrenched away from her. She was hot. She couldn't think. She hadn't been afraid at all, not when she believed that in Nashville she would find more replicas, but now she was panicked and her mouth flooded with the taste of sick. "Do you have any idea how many people there are in this country?" Gemma had asked. "You'll never find him," she had said. She hardly knew where she was going. She just knew she had to get out, away from the noise, away from the music and the crowds. She was desperately thirsty, and whatever energy had carried her this far had abandoned her all at once. She crossed a scrubby parking lot to a 7-Eleven, stepping onto the curb to avoid two boys smoking outside their car, when, just like that, in the space between 1 second and the next, she saw him. Or not him, exactly, but a picture of him, taped to the window of the 7-Eleven. The picture wasn't very good, and most of his features were obscured, but it was definitely him. She recognized the hooded sweatshirt he was wearing, which they'd found together at the clothes-by-the-pound thrift store Rick had taken them to when they'd first arrived at Winston-Abel Mobile Home Park. There were words on the page, but she had to blink several times to make them come into focus. "Smile! You're on candid camera! Thieves will be photographed, shamed, and prosecuted, just like this one." She didn't know what prosecuted meant, but she knew what a thief was. Had Selim stolen something? Was he in trouble? Suddenly, on the other side of the window, a man's face appeared. An ancient face, tufted with hair in strange places and eyebrows that ran to meet each other above the nose. She took a quick step backward before remembering there was glass that separated them. "In or out?" he said. His breath misted the window and his voice was faintly muffled. "Or are you just going to stand there gaping?" Before Lyra could think of an answer, he turned, shaking his head, and stumped back toward the cash register. She followed him. Inside, the air smelled like a shoebox. Several customers stood at the counter, waiting to have items scanned. She detached Selim's photograph from the window where it had been hung. The old man scowled when she approached him with it. "Hello," Lyra said. The guy, so skinny his head looked inflated, blinked at her. "There's a line," he said. Lyra ignored him and spoke directly to the man behind the counter. "I know him," she said, and placed the picture of Selim down on the counter. The man just kept running items past the scanner. "That boy is a thief, young lady," he said. "Tried to lift a package of jerky and a Coca-Cola right from under my nose. I've been in this business a long time. I know a bad seed when I see one." He glared at Lyra as if to say that he was looking at one right that very second. "Sorry," she said, a default word of hers, a word that had always helped at Haven with the nurses and doctors. "Sorry I made too much noise. Sorry I'm in the way. Sorry I breathe, that I'm here. Sorry I have eyes. Sorry I exist. I'm looking for him. That's what I mean. I need to find him."
"You should stay far away from him, is what I think," the old man said.
He'd finished ringing up the skinny guy and gestured the next customer forward. "Please," Lyra said. Her palms were sweating. The overhead lights were very bright. Remembering the lie Rick had coached her on, she added, "He's my cousin." The old man shook his head again, but this time his voice was a little softer.
"I'm not in the business of giving handouts, young lady," he said. "It's a store, not a church. Besides, if I'd let him get away with it, who's to say someone else couldn't just waltz on in here and strip the place?"
"Do you know where he went?" she asked. Fortunately, her voice didn't shake. She had gotten very good at that, at hiding, at burying things deep inside of her. The old man blinked at her as if she'd just appeared.
"Where do you think he went?" he said, scowling again. "The cops took him down to the station, and if I were you, young lady, I wouldn't hurry to bail him out."
Gemma. 8. Inside. The smell of shoe polish, sweat, gunmetal. Two soldiers wearing military fatigues straightened up at their post. They were in a tight corridor, carpeted and filthy. A narrow set of stairs, dirty with footprints, rose into the darkness. Gemma knew once she went up the stairs, wherever they led,
things would be hopeless. "You're making a big mistake," Gemma's voice cracked. How many hours had it been since she'd had anything to drink? "Call my dad. Call him."
"We should have left the gags on," the man holding Pete muttered.
He nudged Pete toward the stairs. Unexpectedly, Pete broke loose, reeling like a drunk. His hands were still bound, but he cracked his head into the man's jaw. Gemma heard the impact of it, a hollow sound. Suddenly, everyone was shouting. Gemma screamed as both soldiers launched for Pete at once.
"Don't hurt him! Please! Please!"
She was too scared even to cry. For a second, she lost sight of him in the shuffle of human bodies. One of the soldiers accidentally caught her with an elbow, and she bit down on her tongue.
"Easy, easy, easy."
The two soldiers hauled Pete to his feet, pinning him between them. Still, he struggled to break loose. Gemma had never seen him look the way he did then, and she thought randomly of a video April had once shown her during her vegetarian phase, how fighting dogs were burned with cigarettes, beaten with sticks, until they were so angry and desperate they would tear each other up, actually tear each other into pieces. The dogs in the video knew they were going to die, and that was what made them fight. They had nothing to live for.
"Let go of me!"
Pete's face was so twisted with raw anger, even Gemma was afraid of him.
"Get your fucking hands off me! You better tell your boyfriend to calm down."
The man who'd been holding Pete was massaging his jawbone. He glared at Gemma.
"Or he's going to get his head blown off."
"Please," Gemma's voice cracked. "Please, Pete."
At the sound of her voice, he finally went still.
"Good boy," one of the soldiers said. "We don't want to hurt you."
Neither Gemma nor Pete bothered pointing out that that was very hard to believe.
"Take him up,"
the man said, still rubbing his jaw and looking pissed about it. This made Pete go wild again.
"Let me stay with her."
But the soldiers pivoted him, with difficulty, toward the stairs.
"Let me stay with her, please."
Gemma let herself cry then. She couldn't help it. She felt as if she were watching Pete through the wrong end of a telescope, getting smaller and smaller, though he was only a few feet away.
"It's okay. It's okay,"
she kept repeating, even as his voice splintered into echoes and then grew fainter, even though it was obviously not okay. Nothing was okay. Nothing would be okay ever again.
"Please,"
she tried one last time to make them listen.
"Please," she said. "I'm telling you the truth. Jeffrey Ives is my father. Ask Dr. Saperstein. Ask anybody."
But she went silent as, down the hall, a door opened and spilled a gut of light.
"What's all the shouting for?"
A woman's voice, low and surprisingly warm, floated out to them. For a moment, she was silhouetted in the light. As she came forward, Gemma experienced a shock of displacement. The woman looked like a soccer mom, like one of Christina's lunch crew. She was even wearing yoga pants.
"Nothing."
The man finally quit massaging his jaw and straightened up.
"Is Saperstein back?"
The yogi shook her head. "Tuesday," she said. Gemma's mouth tasted like plaster, like the soft crumble of a pill. Saperstein knew her father. She'd been counting on the fact that he, at least, would be able to help. She'd comforted herself with the idea that wherever she was being taken, Saperstein would be there. What would happen to her, and to Pete, before Tuesday, when he returned?
"He didn't go to Penn after all, did he?"
"No, Washington." The yogi's eyes swept Gemma. "Where'd you find her?"
"Where we were supposed to."
Gemma's captor was squeezing her arm so tightly, Gemma could feel her fingernails.
"She says it was all a big mistake. She says she doesn't belong here."
"Is that right?" The yogi was still watching Gemma curiously, not meanly, not with disgust or contempt, but with true curiosity. "Well, someone's been feeding her, at least." A fist of hatred tightened in Gemma's stomach.
"I'm not lying,"
she said. I can prove it. Call Saperstein. Ask him yourself. Gemma couldn't tell whether the yogi woman was even listening. She only looked puzzled, as if Gemma were speaking in a different language. After a moment, she withdrew, and Gemma heard the murmur of distant voices. She was speaking to people out of sight. Gemma was dizzy with fear. What was she doing? A minute later, several people wearing medical scrubs flowed down the hall and moved up the stairs without acknowledging either Gemma or the man and woman who'd brought them. They had the same look as all medical staff, harried, professional, too busy to be bothered. The colossal patchwork strangeness of it all, the yoga pants, and the doctor's scrubs, and the soldiers with assault rifles, and the reek of sweat, made a sudden rise of hysteria lift in Gemma's chest. The woman in yoga pants returned, turning her face to the ceiling as if listening to the pattern of footsteps above them.
"Should I take her up?"
Gemma's captor asked, and she shook her head. "In a second. I'm going to bring them down first." "Bring who down?" Gemma blurted out. The woman didn't answer right away. Just then, the sound of footsteps above them grew louder. The door at the top of the landing creaked open, and the doctors or nurses or whatever they were returned. They had brought along three Gemmas. Three Gemmas crowded the stairwell. Three Gemmas gazed down at her. Three Gemmas, scalps shaved clean, wearing filthy t-shirts and pants that bagged from the hollows of their hip bones, chittered like small mice, as if at a funhouse reflection. Gemma lost her breath. A hole opened up beneath her feet. She dropped straight through the floor. Dimly, she was aware that the woman in yoga pants had turned at last to address her.
"My proof," she said simply.
Lyra, 8. It was easy enough, it turned out, to find a police station. Even if you had no idea where you were going, all you had to do, Lyra discovered, was start walking, and eventually, when it started to get dark, the police would find you. She walked down a long street empty of cars. Lyra couldn't exactly be considered lost, since she did not know where she was going. Still, she very definitely did not know where she was. At some point, it had begun to rain. She crossed an empty playground darkened by shattered floodlights. Next to the swings, several guys paused to watch her. The happy rhythm of their conversation abruptly silenced. A woman with a big metal cart piled with plastic bags wheeled slowly down the sidewalk, her feet swollen with rags instead of shoes. Lyra saw a rat picking at trash bags, piled on the street, and the gutters were knotty with empty bottles and old sandwich wrappers and cigarette packs. She had been walking for at least an hour, wondering whether she would recognize a police station if she saw it, and if so, whether she would have the courage to go inside it, when a dark sedan pulled up beside her. "Are you all right?" A man leaned over to squint through the passenger side window. His skin was very dark, and his hair was threaded with gray. He was wearing a dark suit. Lyra's immediate thought was to run. She knew sedans, knew the look of the suits who drove them, knew that they carried smiles along with their guns. But she was trapped. He could easily follow her if she took off running down the block, and there was nowhere to hide, and no possibility of cutting across a nearby park that was hemmed in by a tall chain-link fence. "This isn't a good place for you to be walking this late," the man said. Lyra backed up, shivering, until the fence punched her between the shoulder blades. She wondered if she should scream, but who would help? "Hey," the man's voice got softer. "It's all right. I only want to make sure you're safe out here." Then, "It's okay, you're not in any trouble." Lyra was confused by the tone of his voice. None of the suits had ever spoken to her like that, or looked at her the way he was, as if his eyes were something warm he wanted to give her. And he hadn't come at her with a gun or tried to force her into the car. Maybe then he wasn't a suit. Still, Lyra was frozen. The man didn't move or get out of the car, he just sat there looking at her, his face touched with light from a street lamp on the corner. "Do you speak English?" he asked, and then, "Habla Español?" Then, "My name is Detective Reinhardt. I work with the Nashville Police Department." Finally, Lyra eased her weight off the fence. She was positive now that he hadn't been sent to find her, and she had to be brave if she was going to find Selim, which meant she had to believe him. She hesitated. "I was looking for a police station," she said finally. He stared at her a second longer.
"Get in,"
he said and opened the door. His car was very clean, which relaxed her. A picture of three girls was mounted to the dashboard, and when they passed beneath a street lamp, she saw two of them were identical and felt a kind of ecstatic relief. Twins! She knew, not replicas, but still, it seemed like a sign. The other girl looked older, and she had the policeman's long nose and the same enormous eyes. She wore a bright red headband and had her arms looped around the twins. Her eyes were closed, and she was laughing. He saw her looking.
"The twins are my nieces, my sister's kids, Jamie and Madison, and that's my daughter, Alicia," he said, thumbing the girl in the middle of the photograph. "An old photo. She's in college now."
"She's pretty," Lyra said. He smiled.
"Don't I know it," he said. He had a little bit of an accent like Nurse Curly who'd come from a place named Georgia. "What's your name?" he asked.
"Gemma Ives," she lied quickly. Before leaving Haven, she hadn't been a good liar. But this was a skill she'd rapidly learned that most humans had perfected. It was necessary to lie, living in the human world.
"Nice to meet you, Gemma Ives," he said.
His eyes were big enough to root her in place, as if he wasn't just seeing her but absorbing everything about her, her past and even her future.
"You can call me Kevin."
"Detective Kevin Reinhardt," she recited, and he laughed.
"Just Kevin is fine, like I said."
Lyra was glad that his suit was rumpled and smelled like soft old wool, not sharp like the suits the military men and women wore when they came.
"Why don't you wear a uniform?"
she blurted out. He smiled.
"I'm a detective," he said. "We travel under the radar."
Lyra nodded, though she didn't know what a detective did exactly, but she was glad he wasn't in uniform. Uniforms made her think of Haven and its guards, of the soldiers who'd pursued them out on the marshes. "You know how expensive these things are to make?"
"Now," Detective Kevin Reinhardt said, "why don't you tell me what you need a police station for?"
She wasn't used to being spoken to in that tone, as if she might have something valuable to say. She told him her cousin had been picked up for stealing.
"You know what precinct got him?" he asked.
She shook her head and repeated what the man at the 7-Eleven had said. "He tried to lift a package of beef jerky and a can of Coca-Cola. They took him down to the station." They were stopped at a red light. The policeman turned to look at her again. She felt the way his eyes moved from her hair, still shorter than most of the boys she had seen since leaving Haven, to her bare arms, to the flimsy backpack with someone else's name written on it in marker.
"You know, if you're in trouble, you can tell me,"
he said, still in that same low and gentle voice, as if he was singing instead of speaking. He wasn't like other police officers she had seen on TV, or even the few she'd encountered since leaving Haven. His face looked as if it had been dimpled permanently into an expression of understanding.
"If someone's hurting you, you can just let me know right now, right here, and I'll help you out and make sure you're safe and no one hurts you again. That's my job."
The darkened city outside their windows was awash of blue tones and hazy cones of color from the street lamps. Then she realized, to her shock, that her eyes were leaking. That's what they'd called it at Haven, never crying. Tear duct inflammation, leaking eyes, overactive lacrimal production. Crying meant feelings, and the replicas didn't feel, or at least the humans pretended they didn't. Probably that made it easier for them not to feel either. That way they could do their jobs, draw their paychecks, and sleep soundly. For a second, she fantasized about telling Detective Kevin Reinhardt everything, about all the pills and medications and lies, the harvesting procedures and the testing, and the MRIs, the small prions deformed like bits of melted plastic, whirring through her blood and bone marrow. In the end, what came out was half-truth.
"I'm sick,"
she said. I'm dying. My cousin takes care of me. He's the only person in the world who does. What about your parents? The policeman asked. Where are they? She thought of Rick and the dry skin around his mouth, the way he squinted through his cigarette smoke when they were target shooting, the smell of hot dogs and frozen soup. She thought of Dr. O'Donnell, her blonde hair like a vaporous haze barely clinging to her head. She thought of Cassiopeia bleeding out in the marshes, of the yellow crop bundled up for disposal, of Jake Witz hanging by his own belt. My parents are dead, she answered. Everyone's dead. We came all the way from Florida on our own.
Florida? He repeated. Must have been a long trip.
It was. Suddenly she couldn't stop talking. Words skittered off her tongue like insects trying to beat a path home before they were trampled. We lived on a small island and saw all the same people every day. There was water everywhere in all directions and alligators that lived in the marshes. There was a fence. She sucked in a quick breath. She'd nearly revealed too much. There was a fence to keep them out. She looked down at her hands, surprised at how badly she actually missed Haven. There were birds there, lots of birds, more birds than people. It sounds like a beautiful place, Detective Kevin Reinhardt said, and turned off the car engine. They had arrived somewhere she assumed was a police station, a one-story brick building and big windows through which more police in uniform were visible. How old are you? This lie came easily, too. 21, she said, because she had learned from Raina that this was a magic age, even if she didn't quite understand why. Raina had complained about not being 21 yet, about all the bars and concerts and parties that were 21 and over, about getting kicked out of some place for not being 21. So Lyra figured that once you turned 21, you got special rights to exist. My niece had brain cancer, he said finally. Jamie, the one in the picture, took her when she was 14 years old. Cancer is what you're sick with, isn't it? But there are clinics, treatments. You should be under the care of a doctor. I am, Lyra said. That's where I'm heading, to UPenn in Philadelphia, to see my doctor. As soon as she said it, she knew it was exactly what they had to do. Lyra and Selim had been wrong about Nashville. There was no God here, which meant they had only one option left. They had to find their original God. They would ask him to help. They would demand it. Detective Reinhardt's relief was obvious. She could almost smell it coming off him, like a particular odor of sweat. My daughter almost went to UPenn. Opted for Columbia instead. Philadelphia's a great city. I know a guy at UPenn Hospital. He looked at her sideways. Who's your doctor up there? This time Lyra couldn't think fast enough to lie. She said, Dr. Saperstein? Hoping he wouldn't recognize the name. Luckily, he didn't appear to. He just gave her a quick pat on the knee. I'll take care of your cousin, don't you worry. No one's going to jail for wanting a soda, all right? You just leave it to me. They got out of the car. A rush of black overtook Lyra when she stood up. The rain had turned to a heavy, hot vapor that hung in the air. Who knew what would happen to her once she followed Detective Kevin Reinhardt inside? He seemed okay, but the doctors and nurses at Haven had seemed okay, and all the time they'd been filling her up with disease, tending not her but the disease inside that would eventually sweep away her memories and her words, seize her arms and legs, numb her throat until she couldn't swallow. Still, she followed Detective Reinhardt inside, shy in the sudden brightness. Police officers wove between a jigsaw puzzle of wooden desks. The room stank of old coffee and new ink. A phone seemed to ring every 5 seconds. Don't be shy now, Detective Reinhardt put a hand on her shoulder when she hesitated in the doorway. You go on and get comfortable and I'll be back in a hurry. Now, what did you say your cousin's name was again? Lyra froze. She pictured her mind as a series of computer monitors, all of them darkened at once by a power surge. There was no way Selim would have given his real name. But she couldn't think of the name he would have invented. But she was lucky. Finally, she was lucky, because even as she hesitated, she heard someone shout. Turning, she saw Selim rising from a plastic chair to greet her, trying as hard as he could not to smile, not to grin, and failing totally. So they stood together 25 feet apart in a police station in Nashville, Tennessee at 9 p.m. on a Sunday, and laughed.
Gemma. 9. Finally, Gemma was escorted upstairs. The airport terminal was crawling with military personnel, but also people in medical scrubs, rendered identical by their dirty hair and look of shared exhaustion. One woman dressed in a pantsuit, who resembled a fashion mannequin on Fifth Avenue, kept massaging her forehead with perfectly manicured fingers. Gemma didn't even want to know what government agency she'd crawled out of. The airport was dizzying, not so much because of its size, but because of its regularity. The identical halls, stripped of furniture, counters, vendors, arrivals, screens. There were very few working lights, and new ribs of plywood divided room from room. The ceiling panels were missing. Gemma was led to a bathroom with no stalls at all, just toilets bolted to the floor at regular intervals. A nurse was summoned. She was wearing a shapeless medical smock over her street clothes and had that blind mole look of someone who'd just been asleep. To unbutton Gemma's reeking pants and underwear and haul them to her hips while Gemma peed, since her wrists were still bound. The nurse's hands were cold. Gemma tried to blink away the sudden pressure of tears. The woman's finger swept the place between Gemma's legs when she went to hitch up Gemma's underwear and then jeans.
"Sorry," the nurse whispered. "We'll find you something dry to put on in a bit."
But Gemma felt something come down around her, some inner space collapsing. There was no air conditioning. If it wasn't obvious enough from the smell of must and raw wood, from the filthy corners and cables of dust visible through open gaps in the walls, it was clear to her now, whatever this place was, it wasn't like Haven. There was no experimentation here, no medical treatments or analyses. This was a holding pen, pure and simple. Outside the bathroom, the woman in the pantsuit was waiting, yawning behind a hand. She straightened up and frowned briefly at Gemma.
"Well?"
"Well what?" the nurse responded, keeping a hand on Gemma's elbow. Her touch was surprisingly gentle, as if she wanted to make up for what had happened in the bathroom.
"That's the last of them, isn't it?"
"How should I know?" The two women obviously despised each other.
"That's your business. What I'm supposed to do is keep them alive."
Gemma disliked the way she emphasized that. It suggested the other woman's business was something else entirely.
"No need to get defensive. I was just asking. They all look the same to me, even the ones that aren't doubled."
"I bet." The nurse's voice was hard with sarcasm. "We still have bodies to match. Some of them no more than fingers, thanks to you." She sniffed. "But if you say so, you say so." They moved again down the hall, cavernous with shadow, and half-splintered spaces suggesting their original purpose. Countertops, old glass display cases where she imagined sandwiches withering behind glass. Something smelled. A trash smell. An inside-of-the-body smell. The scent of urine was strong. They stopped to draw water from a long industrial sink. Plastic cups overflowed a massive trash can. The nurse had to hold the cup while Gemma suckled at it like a baby, but she was too thirsty to say no. Then, to her surprise, the woman turned Gemma and released her handcuffs. Gemma nearly fainted from the rush of pleasure, of relief, when she could move her shoulders freely. But she understood, as the woman gestured her on, why the restraints weren't necessary. Patterns of footsteps sounded softly on the linoleum, overlapping, like the drum of distant rain. Soldiers with guns. Even when they hung back in the dark, she could see the barrels winking like animal eyes. "Be a good one now, and you won't get in any trouble," the nurse said. For the first time since being taken into the van, she felt a spark of hope. This woman wasn't evil. Maybe she could be made to understand, to believe.
"Please listen to me," Gemma spoke in a whisper. Her throat was raw from crying. "My name is Gemma Ives. I live in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I have parents. They're looking for me." She couldn't tell whether the woman was even listening. This part of the airport was almost completely dark. A runner of cheap battery pack lights lit a narrow aisle of floor, like those on an airplane designed to help you find your way to the emergency exit. Around them, furniture was lumped and piled and stacked in the darkness. It looked like a whole warehouse had been emptied. The smell was terrible, too. It was so bad it had weight and form and even movement. They paused briefly in front of a set of plastic shelves piled with cheap T-shirts and plain cotton pants, laundered to the point of stiffness. "Laundry day's Friday," the nurse said. "You'll get a replacement soon as you turn in this pair." "Please," Gemma said. She found herself speaking in a whisper, as once again fear flooded into her, poured down her throat like the taste on the air, like the grit of human skin and nails. "I don't belong here." Someone moaned, then a cry in the dark, quickly stifled. But the sound seemed to find Gemma, to burrow deep in her chest like a hook. And at the same time her eyes adjusted, she realized that what she'd mistaken for piles of furniture were really people. Girls. Hundreds of girls, dressed identically, some of them visibly wounded, others so thin they looked like a wreckage of bones, sleeping on the floor, on mattresses, on piles of fabric and tarps, on stacked blankets. "Nobody belongs here, child," the nurse said. She was holding her throat. Gemma saw a small gold cross nested between her fingers. "Not even the devil himself."
Lyra, 9. Detective Kevin Reinhardt kept his word and made sure that no charges were filed against Selim. By the time he announced that Selim was free to go, it was nearly midnight, and Lyra had fallen asleep in one of the plastic chairs in the waiting room with her head on Selim's shoulder, directly beneath a large framed poster of the singer named Elvis she had originally mistaken for another Dr. Saperstein. Detective Reinhardt volunteered to drive them back to the Greyhound bus station, although he warned them it was likely the buses to Philadelphia wouldn't run until the morning, and that the neighborhood was a bad place to go wandering. Lyra told him they planned to wait inside the station, that they didn't mind spending the night on the floor. "You got somewhere to stay once you get up to Philly?" he asked them, once they arrived at the station. "You got friends up there, people you know?" "Oh, sure," Lyra said. "Lots of people. It'll be just like home to us." It wasn't exactly a lie. Lyra had told Selim that they would find God there at a place called Upen. It was a slim hope. Dr. Saperstein might simply put them in a cage, as he had done back in Haven, but their only one. He had filled Lyra with sickness. He might, she thought, be able to remove it. "You need help or run into trouble, you just give me a call," he said, and gave her a small white card with his name printed on it and more numbers she now knew must connect to his telephone. "I want you to study that number. Memorize it, okay? Promise me." Lyra nodded, overwhelmed. Other than Gemma, Detective Reinhardt was the first person to give her a number, his number, to call. She felt holding the card as if she were holding something fragile, something sacred and beautiful. She blinked to clear her eyes of tears and watched the numbers sharpen and flow into a pattern, make a sentence in her mind. "I promise," she said. Climbing out of the car, however, she felt a strong pull of dread. She thought again of Jake Witz, of finding him swinging from a door jamb, his face swollen and discolored, and the cleanup crew who'd come afterward to make sure that no one would ask questions. He too had offered help. Rick had helped, and she was sure that by now, the people who'd taken him in their car had murdered him. She hoped this man, Detective Kevin Reinhardt, wouldn't end up hanging from a rope. It was by then after midnight, and no buses would run for hours. Several people lumped on the benches to sleep might have been distant rock formations. It was quiet and still, except for an old man pacing and muttering darkly to himself. She wanted to ask Selim why he had gone off without her, but she was worried about what his answer would be. Besides, she felt sick again. A seesaw was starting in the bottom of her stomach, back and forth, slowly tossing acid up in the back of her throat. They went in search of ginger ale. The vending machine at the station was out of everything but Coke. At Haven, she had had ginger ale regularly because along with the anti-nausea drugs they got delivered orally or piped in through an IV, the nurses distributed warm ginger ale in small paper cups. The taste of ginger ale reminded her in equal measure of Dr. O'Donnell and of the box, and so she loved and hated it also in equal measure. Nothing was open this late. They kept walking. Lyra's legs felt strange and sticky as if they were made of metal that had rusted. She was exhausted. Her relief at being reunited with Selim only made her aware of how lost she would have been without him. It wasn't, therefore, exactly relief. Though Detective Reinhardt had said it was a bad place to walk, she felt that with Selim next to her, nothing bad could ever happen again. But several blocks from the bus station, Lyra became aware of a change in the shadows around them. A subtle rearrangement of the nighttime noise of that foreign city. They were being followed. They'd been herded, actually, unconsciously trying to outpace the voices even before they knew what the voices meant. They had wound up on a narrow one-way street that contained nothing but a shuttered auto parts supply store and a vacant warehouse. Before Lyra had a chance to warn Selim, they were surrounded. 5 men, not much older than Selim was, and 1 girl who hung back, keeping her eyes on her phone. The light from the screen made strange shadows on her face. The 5 boys tossed Lyra's backpack and took the wallet Gemma had given Lyra, which held Gemma's bank cards and all of her money. But what really made Lyra angry was the way they scattered her stuff. The bottle caps and old plastic bags filled with clinging, browning plant matter, and coins and a rusted pin shaped like an apple— all the things she'd collected and cared for at Winston Abel. "You a trash lady or something?" one of them said, and hurled away a pen, her favorite pen, its end deformed by chewing. They made fun of Selim for the knife he carried. "You need more than a pair of tweezers, you swag around here like we're supposed to know you," and insisted he hand over his money, stolen, Lyra knew, from the cash box at work, and even his belt, which one of the boys wanted. Selim did what they said without a word. Still, Lyra could feel anger like heat ticking off him, subtle waves of it that made her light-headed. When one of the guys moved to touch Lyra's cheek, Selim began to growl. At first, the boys thought this was funny, and they laughed. "Look at this guy. He's like a cat or something." A second guy stepped forward and tried to push Selim. Quickly, even as a passing car threw light briefly onto the brick wall behind them and then darkness crowded in after it, Selim changed. He was a person, and then he was something less, something animal and old. He lunged, snapping his teeth. The guy wrenched his wrist away, finally. "Freaks?" he said. Though Selim and Lyra were drastically outnumbered, the power had shifted. "Freaks?" he said again. And when he met Lyra's eyes, he looked afraid. "Come on, let's get the fuck out of here." After they were gone, Lyra bent to retrieve her scattered belongings, but she couldn't distinguish her things, her special things, from the trash in the gutter, little knobby strangers that meant nothing to her, snub-nosed cigarette butts, tongues of gum stuck to their wrappers. "Are you all right?" Selim asked her. It was practically the first thing he had said to her directly since they'd laughed together like idiots in the police station. She didn't answer him. She was nauseous and tired, and they had nowhere to sleep and no money to buy a bus ticket either. She hated the group of boys who'd followed them and laughingly upended her backpack to shake her things into the gutter. She hated the girl who stood there with her eyes stuck to her phone screen, the girl who couldn't even be bothered to look. How could they be people the same way that Detective Reinhardt and Gemma and her friend April were people? The difference between people and replicas was one of ownership. Real people owned, and they took. And replicas were owned. A difference of action and object. "Lyra," Selim said when she didn't answer. How to sort out her things from the flow of human waste. Where did all these things come from, and who is discarding them so easily? It seemed to Lyra that the whole human world was built on waste and trash and things manufactured just so that they could be tossed out afterward. She couldn't save it all. She could never rescue everything. "Lyra, please, talk to me. You left without me." It wasn't what she had been planning to say, but once the words were out of her mouth, she knew that she was still furious at him. "You were just going to leave me behind. You didn't even say goodbye." "I thought I was doing you a favor," Selim said. "You seemed happy." "I was happy because we were together," she said. "I thought we would always be together, at least until..." She found out she couldn't think about her sickness. She couldn't say the words out loud. At Haven, death had never seemed particularly scary. It was a bald, natural fact, like the transformation of food through the digestive tract. Replicas were born, they got sick, they died. Their bodies were bundled and burned. Some days she would be ash sifting through the ocean waves to be consumed by half-blind deep-water fish. "I'm sorry." He knelt so she had no choice but to look at him. "I didn't want to leave you. I didn't," he said, reaching out to touch her face so she couldn't turn away. He placed a hand on the back of her neck, and her body responded as it always did, as if she were something hollow, a husk, a leaf, and he the wind lifting it. "I thought it would be best. I thought it was protecting you." Another passing car threw up a quick wedge of light. Selim looked so beautiful it was almost painful. She was relieved when the darkness chased the car away again. She stood up. "What are we going to do now?" They had nothing of any value, and Lyra knew by now that everything in the real world cost money. You needed money to eat, and money to sleep, and money even to use the bathroom in public places, which were for patrons only. Selim was quiet. "We'll find a way," he said. "What if Dr. Saperstein won't help us?" Selim's smile was as thin as a razor. "We'll make him." They backtracked to the station, thirsty now and moneyless and ticketless. They hunched down in a dark alcove near the men's bathroom, with its smell of armpits and old urine, and waited for morning to come. Lyra balled her pink sweatshirt up beneath her head for a pillow. She closed her eyes and felt the nausea rise and fall like a swell of water, and she was scared. She pictured her own body like a night sky, a web of black tissue and small disease cells burning like stars inside it. She closed her eyes and saw, instead of darkness, a blinding light, the compression of all that light, all that energy, into a single blazing explosion. She woke up swallowing a scream that came up in the toilet with splatter. In her vomit, small comet trails of blood. Whether she made it to Philadelphia or not, she was running out of time.
Part 2. Gemma. 10. Christina Ives spent the first day of her 51st year crying and picking the cuticles of her fingernails until they bled, and then shivering damply in bed, waiting for the Xanax to take effect, and the second day counting all the ugly things she could find on the way to Nashville, Tennessee. A dead deer mangled on the side of the highway, a house punched in by age and neglect, spilling its rot onto the porch as if it had been gutted, billboards advertising strip clubs, triple X stores, erectile dysfunction clinics. Since having Gemma, she'd hardly ever traveled. She liked to be home with her things, in the beautiful house with the rugs that went hush, hush, with Rufus and the cats and the pool in summertime, where she could lie out with a book, her feet damp with dew and new grass, the hum of a lawnmower in the background, like the pleasant buzz of one of her pills. They had a house in Vail, and Jeff hosted clients there several times a year. But she hadn't been, not since Gemma was a toddler. Though Jeff had urged her to learn to ski, she could never see the point in it. The suiting up and the rentals and the waiting in line to crank all the way to the summit, only to plunge down the mountain again. One time, only one time, he'd convinced her to put Gemma in ski school. She was maybe 4 years old, so young even she didn't remember the experience, and Christina had stood with a crowd of other parents in the lodge while outside a group of fluorescent children made pie wedges with their skis. No one else was worried. The other mothers and the scattered father drank spiked hot cocoa or went off on runs of their own.
but Christina had stayed at the window pane, her breath misting the glass, watching the little gob of purple that was her only daughter, funny-faced and precocious, with cheeks so fat Christina had to stop herself from biting them. She'd read once that during World War II, many of the Jews had sewn their precious belongings, jewels and watches and things, into the lining of their coats before fleeing, and she'd immediately understood. Gemma was like that, like a secret precious thing sewed not into the lining of her coat, but into who she was deep down, at her core, as a person. She saw it even before it happened, saw Gemma's puffy-coated arms begin flapping frantically, saw her teeter on her tiny skis. And she saw, at the same time, beneath Gemma's coat and beneath her skin, to the webbing of her narrow bones and all the fragile organs tucked among them, so easily punctured, ruptured, burst. And she was out the door and running, calling for Gemma to stop, be careful, stop, so that Gemma, looking up at her mother, lost her balance and fell. So Christina didn't go to Vail anymore. They had a place in the Outer Banks, but there too she rarely went. Gemma loved it, but Christina could never keep down images of Gemma drowned in the waves, pummeled by sand, her lungs bloated with seawater. And she had another fear, that she would have to bring Gemma to an unfamiliar hospital, that blood would be drawn, or bones x-rayed, and somehow the doctors would know. That evidence of Christina and Jeff's crime might be encoded in every single one of Gemma's cells, embedded in the filaments of her DNA. She'd been in the kitchen, rinsing out stray wine glasses that Jeff must have collected from the deck, when the call came in. Sunday, her favorite day. She never minded washing dishes, even though they had helped to do that. She liked the sound of rushing water, the soap steam clouds, the way the glasses chimed when she tapped them with her nails. Gemma? She answered the phone automatically. No one else would be calling so early on a Sunday. But it was April, and as soon as Christina heard the sound of April's voice, she knew. Ms. Ives? That was a tell, too. April never called her anything but Christina, not since she was in third grade. I'm worried about Gemma. And then in a rush, April had told her everything. That Gemma had not, in fact, slept over. That she had gone with Pete to see Lyra down in that tragic little shoebox her husband had shoved Rick Harless into. That she should have been back already. She wasn't back, though, and she wasn't picking up her phone, and Pete wasn't picking up either. By some miracle, Christina had managed to locate a telephone number for Rick Harless, scrawled on a notepad, and wedged deep in the junk drawer, along with all the other miscellaneous things they couldn't stand to look at, but knew might prove useful someday. Rick's home number just rang and rang, and his cell phone went straight to voicemail. She went right away to Jeff, as she always did, as she had been trained to do. He had the idea to check Gemma's debit card activity and see whether she had taken out any money. In the very early morning, Gemma had purchased tickets from Knoxville, Tennessee, to Nashville. In the afternoon, she had taken out $200 from an ATM in Crossville, Tennessee. Around midnight, someone used her ATM card to check into a Four Crossings motel in Nashville, and although by this morning that proved to be a false lead, the girl and boy in room 22 had obviously stolen Gemma's wallet, although they claimed simply to have found it. Still, they must have stolen it from Gemma, which meant she had gone to Nashville. But why? For what reason? And why was her phone dead, and Pete's too? Where, for that matter, was Rick Harless? "You promise you know absolutely nothing about this?" she had asked Jeff, after a terrible sleepless night, half-drowning in barbiturate dreams. "You swear you had nothing, nothing at all to do with it?"
"Of course not." Jeffrey's answer was quick. "How could you even think that?"
And she believed Jeff because that was what she did, what she was compelled to do, the way the Earth was compelled to go around the sun. They built the belief together, carefully, spinning turrets, ice-thin pillars, delicate vaulted ceilings, alive with all the stories they'd made. Even a single